NATO and cannot exploit America's political divisions. Putin's apparent belief that he has the momentum and can keep Europe divided is the essential factor that NATO must overcome. I'm Mel Gertoff for The Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, April 23rd, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Jenka Soderberg and Mel Gertov. The producer is Josh Salem, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Catherine Carley, Eric Tegatoff, Edwin J. Vieira, Freder Ross, and Antonia Gonzalez. The director of the evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Josh Salem. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO's News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Today, Tuesday, April 23rd, 2024, marks 200 days of the Israeli invasion of Gaza. Over 15,000 children have been killed. They are among the more than 34,000 Palestinians who have been killed by Israeli forces since October 7th, 2023. Every university in Gaza has been destroyed, as well as thousand-year-old churches and mosques, libraries, museums, and hundreds of thousands of family homes. 1.5 million displaced Palestinians have fled from the north and central Gaza to the southernmost tip of the imprisoned coastal enclave, the city of Rafah. There, tent camps have been set up with makeshift materials, and Israeli forces continue nightly bombardment with U.S.-made F-16 and F-35 aircraft, as well as unmanned drones. At least 7,000 Palestinians have been abducted by Israeli forces since October 7th, adding to the over 4,000 already in Israeli detention. They are being held in horrific conditions, not allowed access to lawyers or a court system, and over 40 have died from being tortured to death in prison camps, including the Sde Tamon prison camp in southern Israel. Others who have managed to be released have shown before and after pictures from their months in captivity and all look like they have aged 10 years in the prison camps. Some Palestinians in the prison camps have had limbs amputated after being held in isolation with plastic wrist and ankle cuffs on 24/7 for weeks and months on end. Israeli authorities say this brutal invasion and decimation of the Gaza Strip is a response to the horrific attack on October 7th, in which 1,100 Israelis, including 700 civilians, were killed in a single day. But Israeli journalists have pointed out that the terrorist attack of October 7th was the pretext for the Israeli government to carry out a long-standing plan to invade the Gaza Strip to expel the Palestinian population, construct a seaport and colonial settlement, and exploit the natural gas reserves off the Gaza coast. In the past several months, in fact, the Israeli government has issued 3 exploratory permits for Israeli companies to begin exploiting the natural gas reserves off the Gaza coast. There were an estimated 240 Israelis taken hostage by Palestinian groups on October 7th. Over 100 were released in a well-publicized prisoner swap in the beginning of December, which many had hoped would lead to a permanent ceasefire. But Israeli bombardment continued unabated. On April 10th, negotiations for a ceasefire seemed close to reaching an agreement, with Palestinian leader Ismail Haniyeh of the political wing of the Hamas party talking through a third party in Qatar to negotiate a prisoner swap. But then Israeli planes bombed Haniyeh's family in Gaza, killing his three sons, Hazem, Amir, and Mohammed, and four grandchildren, three girls and a boy. Since then, negotiations have been stalled. This past week, student activism in the U.S. has really stepped up, following the decision by Columbia University in New York to bring in police to arrest 100 students holding an encampment for peace in Palestine. Thousands more students and supporters came to support the arrested students setting up a new encampment, and other universities are also organizing encampments in support of a permanent ceasefire and an end to the Israeli military occupation of Palestine, as well as the divestment of their schools from the Israeli military. These include New York University, Harvard University, the University of California at Berkeley, Sydney University in Australia, and Buenos Aires University in Argentina, as well as the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, which has contracts with the Israeli military for weapon production. At McGill University in Montreal, Canada, two students are entering the critical stage of an open-ended hunger strike, calling for McGill to divest from companies contracted with the Israeli military. Two students were hospitalized on day 33 and 34 of their respective hunger strikes. Now two other students have taken their place, continuing the open-ended hunger strike for Gaza. Both are reaching 30 days of hunger strike. I spoke with Blue, a student organizer in Montreal, about the student hunger strike.
We're seeing, I think a lot of the universities are kind of globally and across like Turtle Island are in very like similar wavelengths of like, you know, trying to go through like motions, passing motions, having like lots of teach-ins, getting people educated and trying to mobilize people through rallies, through protests, and yeah, try to go through like McGill administration, maybe I can touch on this later, loves to say, go through the channels, the proper channels for divestment. You know, you go through this long, lengthy process of like that is really complicated, and it's intentional that it's complicated to request divestment. Maybe they'll listen to you. Maybe they'll listen to you. And so people have been mobilizing and gathering and starting groups and joining groups focusing, trying to like centralize, okay, like how are we complicit? Like, because everyone in the world is complicit right now through our financial ties, whether it's through institutions or through our tax dollars. We're all have been forcibly complicit in the funding of the Israeli military through our money and through our governments. And so we have, I think the idea mostly for university students is like, we go to these institutions and they're like colonial institutions, and they've consistently and historically caused like so much damage in the local indigenous communities and in Palestine and in other places, and have historically been involved in, like, for example, McGill, the South African apartheid. And so the point is, with mobilization right now, is trying to get our universities to either or do an academic boycott of Israeli institutions and to divest. So basically following the BDS model that everyone, that has been really powerful. I think that we're all witnessing the power of BDS. So BDS means boycott, divest, sanction. And it's basically, like I was mentioning before, like what we pay into and where our money goes is, if we look at the research and if we look at the research done in BDS, it will always link it back to maybe this company is either on occupied, like illegal, like a settlement, or the money of this company, they send like millions to weapon manufacturing companies that directly go to the Israeli army, that could directly arm the Israeli army. So the point is of BDS is that like our money ties back to Israel and our money ties back to weapon manufacturing companies. And a lot of these, what we're witnessing is a lot of these companies and universities, like, why are universities invested in weapon manufacturing companies? That's what we'd all like to know. No one has answered that to us yet. But that's the point of BDS, is that our money is linked back to funding the IDF. And if we can cut off money from that, that is a way that we can not arm and fund this genocidal occupational force. So it's one tactic through money. We thought it would, you know, given that we're on hunger strike, maybe people would care, maybe they'd listen. So that was the request, and it started with two indefinite hunger strikers, and I would say about 12 rotating hunger strikers, so people in the McGill or extended community. I also started off as like a rotating, it's very bare minimum, it's 2 days a week, just as like, I guess, to support. And so people go from like 2 days to 6 days a week, but like people were hunger striking. And then 34 days in, we had Rania, who was hospitalized. And then 36 days into his hunger strike, and he started a little later because he has, he started a little later. Shadi was hospitalized. So we had two students hospitalized, and different people starting indefinite at different points. And just as a whole, this has been happening for 61 days. You know, I've never participated in a hunger strike before, and there's a need for like support. There's a lot of logistical planning and organizing that goes around into this, and like caretaking, and like, you know, making sure our the people that we're working with and that we love deeply, like, don't die on hunger strike, and that we can find ways that that our message can get across and that people know that this is happening.
And so you said the two people went to the hospital, Rania and was it Shadi?
Yeah, Shadi.
So they, what's happened to them since?
When Rania was hospitalized, there was a big media outburst. And what we've kind of been discussing is how reactionary the media is, and how we were kind of only really taken seriously right when, you know, Rania's life was like actually at extreme risk. And so they have been, she has stepped, she's been hospitalized and then was in the hospital for, I want to say, 5 to 6 days. And she's recovering right now. Like, she's recovering. It's extremely traumatizing, everything that has happened. It's extremely like vulnerable, and to have like your body and your health, like your hospitalization, it really so personal, like just broadcasted to the media and then just kind of forgotten about. It's been extremely, I think a lot of us are seeing how desensitized and numb and apathetic, like how much that runs within like Western culture. Because here we are, like, it's beyond even the 6 months of genocide. This has been happening for 76 years, but we are just seeing, I think a lot of people are waking up to how numb that people are, that this can take place. And I think in a personal experience, like seeing that, you know, people can like see that, especially the administration, I want to say specifically, because the administration, that they can see that your students are willing to quite literally die. I hate saying that, but people die on hunger strike, and we're 61 days in, we're two hospitalizations in, and we've had like a bare minimum meeting. There's been no actions taken into caring about their students' well-being. And that is like, there's no words for that. There's like, it's harm beyond, there's no words for that. So to just see how there's been so little even care, other than like lip service and fake, oh, that's bad, or, you know, from a distance over email, oh no, don't hunger strike, that's too bad. It's really disgusting to see how robotic the administration and people have been And it's not, we don't want to hunger, we don't want to like center the hunger strikes suffering. Like, I think people have been very clear, they don't want to center themselves because this is a choice, and it's to bring attention to what is happening in Palestine right now. But the fact that, you know, you'd think, just because maybe it's a little closer to home, you'd think like people in the West would care a little more. I don't want to say people, because I know a lot of people care. I don't want to say people, but it's just been really frustrating seeing that the administration cannot even care. They don't care about the 40,000 Palestinian people that have been murdered, and they very much do not care about their own students. And we were naive enough to think that they would care. Why do we get to, like, at school, like, why do we get to I took a semester off. I could not understand how every day I would go into class and we're just pretending that our tuition money is not going to bomb universities and murder teachers and students. Like, my brain cannot, and I don't think anyone's brain can understand how life is continuing. And I think of Samar Al-Qadour, a woman, a Palestinian mother whose daughter died in Gaza recently, because, and waiting to come over to Canada, so-called Canada, to her mother, and died. And every single day, and if anyone's listening, I would love for people to like go check her out. Samar Al-Qadour in Montreal, if you type in Mark Miller, every single day while she's grieving her daughter who was murdered, she's outside protesting outside of Mark Miller's office. Every single day, there has been no space for grief or healing for any Palestinian person who has lost their family. There is literally no space or time. Like, they are not given the privilege of time to grieve. And Samar is outside his office every single day protesting. And to me, that's like, there's nothing else to do. I don't know how else to function. I really don't know how else to function. Everything's the bare minimum. I want everyone to be doing something. I didn't know how to do a hunger strike. I don't know how to do any of this. I think it's all the bare minimum, and we have to work together collectively and really truly reimagine, like, we can't exist like this. We can't exist like this because it's somewhere else. It's our governments are doing this and we're all complicit. There's no other way. Yeah, it's not really inspiration. It's like, it's rage. It's not knowing how else to function is how I feel about this. And I do feel like it is the bare minimum that we can be doing.
That was Blue, a student organizer in Montreal, Canada, where students from McGill University are on an open-ended hunger strike to demand that their university divest from Israeli military investments. More information can be found on the Instagram profile, McGill Hunger Strike. That's MCGILL Hunger Strike. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Jenka Soderberg.
You are listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. Some critics of the U.S. media believe that much of the reporting about the presidential campaign is sadly lacking. Rick Perlstein is one of those critics. He's a journalist and a historian of the post-1960s American conservative movement, and he's the author of several books, including Reaganland. He spoke with KBOO contributor David Rosenberg.
In terms of the way the media is covering the election, Trump and Biden, you think that there's something wrong with that, that somehow they're not really telling the truth about Trump? Is that it? I mean, it seems like they are, in a certain sense. They're saying he's claiming the election was a fraud, but there's no evidence. They will say that, and they will talk about how he contributed to the January 6th insurrection. But what's your take on how they're covering the Trump-Biden race?
Yeah, my interpretation would be a little bit more complicated than that. I think most of the information you need in order to understand, you know, how terrifying Donald Trump is, you know, kind of somewhere in your newspaper, you know. But the problem is not really that the information isn't getting out there. The problem is that political journalism in America these days for a long time follows these very rigid genre conventions, right? There's an overarching narrative. And our politics, you know, over the last, let's say, 7 years since Donald Trump became president, or, you know, 8.5 years since he started running for president, has passed the kind of watershed in a way that, you know, makes it completely different from, you know, politics, say, 30 years ago. You saw all the signs, you know, pointing in this direction, right? But the idea that we have this kind of horse race between two roughly equal formations, it reminds me of kind of like trying to sell the story that way is like trying to pedal a bicycle where the chain is off the gears, right? It just doesn't, nothing matches up anymore. So the problem is the narratives that they use, the tropes they use, the metaphors they use, the intellectual cognitive frames they use, you know, are exactly the same as the ones they would have used in 1996. And that's just a terrible derogation of their duty to just give people an accurate picture of reality. And, you know, there's great work being done. I think there's been especially good work done on, you know, the 2025 project that they have in mind, the Republicans have in mind for kind of stripping the federal government bare for parts and selling it to the highest bidder. There's been good reporting at this late date, you know, and a lot of this is about the good stuff is belated, right? I mean, they should have been doing it 8 years ago, right? I mean, if you know, were following Donald Trump and, you know, say watched a documentary about him that came out in the early 90s called Donald Trump, What's the Deal? You knew exactly what he was. But, you know, I'm talking about media coverage when he was president saying, oh, he's just going to become a normal Republican president as soon as he grows into the role and that sort of thing. Those are the sort of tropes I'm talking about. And, you know, I spend a lot of time thinking about what this will look like to, you know, historians 75 years from now. And, you know, the smart ones will kind of dig in and see how terrifying and dangerous Donald Trump truly was. And then they'll look at the media coverage and they'll say, these things do not match up, right? And that's the horror I'm talking about. You know, that's the kind of
isn't that true? I mean, if you look
back, a lot of things, yes.
Yeah, I mean, if you look back, say, at the Bush administration, you know, mm-hmm. it was a group that led the country into a war that never needed to happen. Of course, you could say that about most U.S. wars, or maybe yeah. all. And then Obama takes office and he and Pelosi don't want to do anything about the fact that the country right. was lied into a war. And, you know, you go back to this the Johnson administration. You know,
yes. I'm doing this column called The Infernal Triangle for the American Prospect. And you can just go to prospect.org and sign up to get it every Wednesday. And it's based on a book I'm writing called The Infernal Triangle. You know, and the triangle I'm referring to is, you know, Republican authoritarianism, like just like you say, Democrat inadequacy in the face of that authoritarianism and media incompetence. And the book itself, you know, starts the story in 2000. You know, I could have started it in 1980 or even 1960, right? These are all trends, right? But the trends have reached their apotheosis. And the greater the civic emergency, the more tragic it is. But it's absolutely true. You know, I went over, you know, very carefully, you know, what the media did in the face of George W. Bush's, you know, transparent lies. You know, I mean, if you listen to KPFA, you probably had people on who were experts on how weapons of mass destruction worked, who said it's impossible that Saddam Hussein is weapons of mass destruction. And yet every day in the editorials of the New York Times and the Washington Post, it was taken as a given. So this is hardly something new, but it's a question of degree. Right. Now that we have someone who literally says the laws don't apply to him, right? We have millions of Americans for whom the very institutions of the justice system are completely illegitimate because they're taking on this leader of their cult of personality. I think we would all agree that America is facing a civic emergency that we saw signs of in the past, in past decades, which has reached a pitch that literally places democracy in jeopardy. And you can hear echoes of that faintly in some of our strong mainstream institutions of journalism, but way too late and way too little.
So do you think part of the problem is the people that Trump brings with him, the Proud Boys, the Oath Keepers, what you might call modern stormtroopers, the extremists of all kinds, and maybe there's even too much emphasis on who he is and just the fact that he would, or he has opened the gates for all these extreme elements to come out of the woodwork. Is that really part of the problem?
I think a really good account of how all this happened would have to include, yes, all the stormtroopers that he's let in the gates. And, you know, I did a piece in These Times about how American mainstream journalism covering politics has consistently and systematically, you know, downplayed the violent elements in the Republican coalition, going all the way back to, you know, the first years of the 21st century, right? So you can find that. But you
well,
also
right, there were thugs down in Florida trying to intimidate Democrats from doing something about the election.
Right. So what we're talking about is basically the Republican Party at this point is a political formulation that has a parliamentary wing and a paramilitary wing. But you have to look also at the parliamentary wing. The fact that someone like Mitch McConnell, starting in the Obama presidency, completely turned the Senate into an even more minoritarian institution than it ever was, routinized the filibuster as a way to turn this, you know, tiny plutocratic elite into the governors of the society. You have to look at something like the Supreme Court, in which suddenly these nine people, six of which are reactionaries, have somehow become the sovereigns who decide the laws of the United States. You know, you have to look at the rise of a Republican coalition that made weaponizing, you know, hatred and racism the basis of their electoral appeal. You have to look at a narrative about Democratic election fraud that literally goes back to the 1960s and the 1960 presidential election. So this is all a very complicated situation, but our journalism doesn't do complicated very well. It's gotten worse and worse and worse. And then you have to bring in, you know, the hollowing out of the journalism business. Journalism, by the way, by the people who founded the country, wasn't even really supposed to be a business. You know, the first law, one of the first laws that Congress passed under the new Constitution in the 1780s, right, was that they made postage almost free for newspapers because they considered the idea that, you know, newspapers should stand or fall on the normal business concerns ridiculous. I mean, they basically socialized the news media. And now we have really...
Although in those days, it was openly partisan, the newspaper.
It was openly partisan, right? And you can also look at, I do this in both my column and my book, the rise of this kind of professionalized journalism discourse in which every problem has to be treated as the equal responsibility of the Republicans and the Democrats, right? And, you know, we have this Democratic Party where the biggest flaw, the biggest, you know, kind of derogation of their duty is acting like Boy Scouts when they should act like, you know, warriors fighting against fascism. And then you have another side that has made lying and cheating and stealing and deception the basis of their appeal. And these two sides are treated as if they were equal. And the way I pointed out is this is done in the name of fighting bias, in the name of so-called objectivity. But if you treat the side that's willing to lie, cheat, steal, and you know, instigate violence as equivalent to the side that acts like Boy Scouts, you're biased. You're biased in the on the side of the side that's willing to lie, cheat, and steal because you know you're giving them a pass, right? I mean, if you are you know, in a boxing match, right, and one of the guys, you know, is doing kidney punches and crotch punches, and he gets called for just as many fouls as the guy who's, you know, following the rules, you would say that the referee is biased, you know, towards the guy who's cheating, right? We have a biased media. They're biased towards the side that lies, cheats, and steals. They're biased towards the Republicans. They're biased towards
Trump. And yet, the right wing will say the lamestream media, as some of them say, is biased against them, and that they're
right. And that's you know, that's the Steve Bannon, you know, kind of model. I mean, which is, you know, he named it, but of course he didn't invent it. It's been going back a long way. Richard Nixon was the master of this, of basically trashing the institutions of journalism itself, you know, much as Vladimir Putin does, is, you know, everyone's cheating like I do, everyone lies like I do, and the journalists are just as bad. And anything you don't agree with suddenly becomes fake news, right? So by turning the media in people's minds into the, just the kind of cesspool that the Republican Party is, it becomes impossible for journalists to get much footing, even when they do do their jobs well.
What is the solution? How does one counter that? I mean, the alternative media does, but that
yes.
kind of still on the margins of society. So how does one break through that?
Well, I mean, I think people at this late date have to be, you know, just even normie people, not the KPFA types, have to be much more open to alternative sources of information, right? We have to be much more critical. I mean, the way we kind of counter this is by, you know, basically becoming much more political, much more politicized. You know, I'm also a historian of the right. And if you ask me, you know, in this series of four books I've written that cover the history of the right from the 50s to the 80s, what is their greatest accomplishment? Why have they succeeded so much when they have so little to offer the American people? It would be that everyone who has any kind of conservative inclination or temperament in the society, whether they're military types or police types or orthodox religious believers, were taught how to be political, right? They were organized into various sorts of political machines, right? Preachers weren't involved in politics until the 1970s. And then people like Jerry Falwell taught them to think of themselves like precinct captains. That's how social workers need to start thinking about themselves. That's how, you know, journalists need to start thinking about themselves. You know, that's how scientists need to start thinking about themselves. Anyone who believes in the basic values of the liberal enlightenment, just basic ideas that human beings are here on earth in order to realize their own potential and not kind of fall into some sort of tribal hierarchy, has to, first of all, vote and make sure everyone they know who agrees with them votes, but also, you know, begin sort of infiltrating the organs of the Democratic Party, just like the right wing of the Republican Party. The right wing took over the Republican Party because, you know, the people running the Republican Party, people running the Democratic Party, I should say, you know, are just not equal to this historical movement.
That was journalist and historian Rick Perlstein speaking.